Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Today in the program, we will explain what it might take for some in the legislature to consider tax increases and what that means for the state.
Sure, we can spend the entire rainy day account down over the next 2 years, and then what?
A controversial plan for restoring Medicine Bow National Forest has just been approved.
It's deeply troubling that the Forest Service wants to accomplish this level of logging across the forest.
And the first chapter of a mountain bike mentor program aims to help teach girls friendship and self-growth.
Female friendship and finding a love for a sport that you can continue on your entire life is really important.
Those stories and more are coming up on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. This week, Governor Mark Gordon started addressing Wyoming's $1.5 billion shortfall with $250 million in budget cuts. The cuts are due to the economic fallout from COVID-19 and a sudden drop in energy prices. Gordon has said he would like to see cuts, reserves, and some new revenue sources, including taxes, used together to address the shortfall. But attaching that last leg of the stool remains difficult. Recently, the legislature's Joint Revenue Committee considered a wide range of revenue options. They included removing many of the exemptions allowed for sales tax, including restoring a tax on food, increasing the sales tax by 1%, and they looked at getting more revenue from property taxes. Casper Representative Pat Sweeney noted that the committee was not approving any taxes. They were just sending a bill to the full legislature for debate.
Even if you signed a pledge and they're totally against raising taxes, that we move, the committee moves us forward because it is going to be a three-legged stool: cuts, revenue, and using part of our savings.
But to no avail. One by one, the committee voted down proposed legislation. Many on the committee have pledged no new taxes, at least until serious budget reductions are made.
But the reality is that we're entering a new period where we're going to have to really, really prioritize our tax dollars.
That's Sheridan Representative Cyrus Western. He's a member of the Revenue Committee and says Wyoming can no longer continue to provide all the services it has in the past and needs to find a more sustainable level. He says cuts are necessary, but he acknowledges they will hurt.
These are our neighbors, our friends, or sometimes our family, people who live in our communities. It's going to be very, very painful.
But Western says they have no other choice. Fellow Sheridan lawmaker Senator Bo Bightman also voted against the proposals, which was no surprise. During the past legislative session, he used terms like "the party is over" when he tried to get fellow senators to support his proposed reductions.
I've been kind of yelling from the rooftops that this kind of spending is unsustainable, and here we are. We as a body haven't had the appetite to make the hard cuts, the cuts to K-12 education, the cuts to UW, and the personnel cuts, not just cutting unfilled positions.
Laramie Representative and House Minority Leader Kathy Connolly find such proposals appalling.
How do we attract people to Wyoming? How do we have an educated workforce, an educated citizenry? Right? I mean, I don't want to cut education.
But many do. It's because education has been deemed off limits due to a funding lawsuit in the 90s. So over the years, education spending has gone up, while a lot of spending in state government has actually gone down. Because of the school funding model, the governor can't make direct cuts to education, but during a recent news conference, he urged school board members to make 10% cuts on their own, which probably won't lead to much. So Representative Western is ready to propose some reforms to the model. He wants the legislature to remove some education requirements and take extracurricular activities out of the model.
These are very important things that can really enhance the experience of a child's educational experience, right? But when you're going to, me as a policymaker, if you're going to put me in a position where I have to prioritize our dollars, I'm going to choose STEM. I'm going to choose to make sure we can pay STEM teachers a good solid wage that we can recruit and retain good teachers.
Western and Biteman say that Wyoming has got to rein in the services it offers the state. But Minority Leader Connolly points out that services cost a lot because Wyoming is so spread out. She says you have to have things like Department of Family Services offices available to all residents. Connolly says it's going to be important for the state to educate people about these things. Governor Gordon says another part of the problem is that people hear a lot about Wyoming's reserves.
What I think most, many Wyoming people may be thinking is we've got all this money. We've got our permanent funds, we've got the LISRA, and we need to get that down to a very simple approach so that people understand there just isn't that much money.
Gordon also believes those who oppose taxes will only come around when the state is in dire circumstances. This is the same thing that Governors Geringer and Sullivan faced in the 1990s. Minority Leader Connolly has a strong reaction to that sentiment.
I think it's irresponsible for us as legislators to go down that road and say, well, not until our neighbors are harmed, our communities are harmed, that we're going to do something about it.
Connolly says it's refusing to do what's necessary. The House Revenue Committee will meet again this fall and can reconsider these bills along with some other proposals. Chairman Dan Swanditzer said he hopes at least a couple pass so they can be considered by the full legislature in January. One of the things the governor hoped would help Wyoming's financial picture was the purchase of 1 million acres of land owned by Occidental Petroleum. It included 4 million acres of mineral rights that Governor Gordon hoped would generate a lot of money. Throughout the process, there were questions about what was going on behind the scenes. Gordon put out a statement following the state's bid withdrawal, looking to answer some of those questions. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim speaks with the governor to talk through that statement.
Obviously, this was a major undertaking to consider and ultimately put forth a bid. There were a number of considerations around it, and to make sure that the public was fully aware of what it was we were doing and we did. We wanted to make sure that we put out a statement, as I had promised, that would indicate exactly what we had bid and kind of the process that we'd gone through to getting there. And so that was the impetus for putting out the statement.
Obviously, you know, as you pointed out in the statement, transparency was one of the big points of contention. So what do you say to those folks who say they wanted more transparency throughout?
Well, with a transaction such as this, there were, at least in one bidding round, there were 13 competitors. In this sort of sealed bid kind of approach, basically saying, here's what Wyoming's going to bid. And so we would have set a value, and it would have been just a complete sort of academic exercise for us to have disclosed everything initially. I did feel it was absolutely important that the members of the legislature knew what was going on. As I mentioned, Cooper, we brought it to the attention of the legislature so that they could fully discuss the topic, and they did. And they ultimately came up with a number of recommendations on process going forward, all of which either we have or would, if we had been successful, would have adhered to.
Orion Mine Finance is the new company in town. Have you spoken with them at all, and do you have any expectations of what that company will mean for the state?
Yeah, I have not had any conversations directly with Orion Mining Finance. I understand that they have reached out to a couple of our agencies, and I have it on good authority that they will be contacting the governor's office. It's certainly an offer that I've extended, saying look forward to meeting with you, and so we feel that the long-term play here is Trona. My guess is Orion Mining Finance also saw that. But what was particular for us was the opportunity really to consider blocking up land in a way that would make public access more available, in a way that would safeguard some of our hunting areas and recreational opportunities. I don't know if Orion Mining Finance has those on their agenda.
Okay, any other points to add before we sign off here?
Well, a little bit about just the uniqueness of the process. I think normally what the state does in these kinds of transactions is we go through an appraisal process. The size of this was so large that there would be no comparable sales. It really became evident as we were looking particularly, let's say, at the real estate and some of the mineral position, that an appraisal wasn't going to be done effectively or in a timely fashion, which is why we reached out to an investment bank. And as I mentioned in the statement, the investment banks that we talked to, actually, I'm aware that three of the ones we talked to, Barclays, Jefferies, and Citi, were all contenders in this. So in one way or another, an investment bank was going to be essential in understanding what the asset was, and essential in completing the transaction should we have been successful.
Well, thanks for making time for me, Governor.
Thank you.
That's Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim. When we come back, it's been an interesting month for the Jackson Police Department. This is Open Spaces.
This season on the Modern West, the rural American West is struggling. Jobs disappearing, schools closing.
No matter where I went, there was always in my heart was I had a hometown, and it was still there waiting for me to come back.
It's the great ghost towning of America. But small towns are fighting back. A new season of the Modern West starts September 16th. Find it under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. It's been a month of turmoil for the Jackson Police Department. A couple of officers resigned last week after a post on the department's Facebook page drew community outrage, and an investigation by the Jackson Hole News and Guide uncovered another incident that raises questions about the culture of the department. Wyoming Public Radio's Savannah Marr spoke with investigative and justice reporter Emily Muir about what she found.
So the post that sparked all of this was written by Officer Roger Schultz. It said that the department was investigating an allegation that a minor had been sexually assaulted, but that they might need coffee and donuts to figure out whether or not a crime had actually been committed. Is that tone typical for the department's Facebook blotter?
It was along the lines of the tone that he maintained in the written blotter, and There were some times in prior blotter posts where I questioned whether or not humor was appropriate, but it never, in my opinion, crossed the line like this one did, because most of those in the past were maybe about DUI or public intoxication or something alcohol related. And this one had to do with an alleged statutory rape, and he has since said that it was unfounded and that there's not really a victim to be had in this case, but a lot of people in the community don't feel like that matters. Either way, he was joking about an investigation into a statutory rape.
Right. What some people pointed out is that whether an assault actually took place or not, that post might send the message that the Jackson PD just doesn't take allegations of sexual violence very seriously.
Yeah, I think that's the biggest concern, especially with advocates in our community who are working with survivors of sexual violence. They worry that this has undone a lot of their work in getting victims to report crimes that they've endured.
So Officer Schultz, who wrote that Facebook post, has resigned. He resigned last week, and so did the chief of police, Todd Smith. How's the community responding to that?
It's been mixed. You know, it's a small community, Jackson. A lot of people know Roger, and they've come to his defense saying that, you know, this one blotter post shouldn't undo a decades-long career. Other people feel that if someone has that type of tone with an alleged crime of that nature, that they shouldn't be in law enforcement.
And this week you had another story where you uncovered an allegation of sexual harassment in the Jackson PD from 2017. How did that come about?
Yeah, so I didn't know about this before. We, as you probably know, in Wyoming, personnel records of government officials are confidential, and so there's not a whole lot of digging you can do when it comes to why an officer leaves or something like that. And so the blotter post stories kind of opened the floodgates, and someone brought that case to my attention. It was kind of like, I think that there was a female officer who left under relevant reasons, and it might be something you want to look into. And I actually was not successful in getting a hold of her, but then I found out that there had been a lawsuit filed, and when she replied, she just laid it all out there. So it ended up being that her complaints were in the public record in our circuit court, and so just the little bit that she shared in the court files, we thought was relevant to the culture that's now in question at the Jackson Police Department.
So this woman was sexually harassed by her coworkers. In those court documents, she included screenshots of another officer and her supervisor sending her inappropriate texts. And the town of Jackson sued her.
Yeah, the Jackson Police Department apparently has a historic issue with officers leaving shortly after the town pays for them to go to the Wyoming Police Academy. And so they started doing these two-year commitments with officers. And so they would sign, as you know, after they accepted the job, they would sign that, you know, if they broke their two-year contract, they would pay whatever amount back to the town of Jackson for breaching contract. So then it's up to the town of Jackson and I believe the town council and the town manager on whether or not they actually sue the officers who breached contract. And in this case, they did sue her. She filed that just on her own. There wasn't an attorney involved that I saw. And then there has been a settlement, but it's not public. So I don't know what they ended up agreeing on.
Right. And have you been able to get the new acting chief of police, Michelle Weber, to respond to any of this, either about the incident with the blotter or about the 2017 harassment allegations?
She sent a letter to the community. She published a letter to the community through the town of Jackson, and it did address some of the concerns that have been brought up from the blotter post. She published that before I found out about the sexual harassment claims from the former officer, and I did call her when I found out about it to let her know and to give her an opportunity to comment further, and she decided not to.
What questions do you still have for the Jackson PD?
Gosh, I think a lot of it comes down to the culture that's in question and a little bit of the fraternity-like or locker room chat that is often how it's described. But I think there are certain things that hopefully I can get answered from the new acting chief, Weber, once she, you know, kind of gets settled in. And how much of that is just the norm there, and whether or not she sees that as an issue, and what's going to be done about it. They have promised to do implicit bias training. So we're going to cover that and hopefully just continue to ask, you know, what's expected of the officers there and if they're breeding a culture that makes anyone, female, male, feel safe.
That was the Jackson Hole News and Guides investigative and justice reporter Emily Muir. In his teens, Tate McKinney started coming to terms with his sexual orientation and gender identity. Like many LGBTQ kids in small towns, That led to hard conversations with his family. But then he found out he was related to Aaron McKinney, one of Matthew Shepard's murderers. Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards sat down with Tate to hear his uniquely Wyoming story.
Yeah, it was definitely something none of my family really talked about. And then I think I was probably in junior high, probably like 7th or 8th grade, and my dad mentioned it in passing. He just mentioned Aaron, I think, and how he was in prison. And that's when I kind of got looking into it myself. I was like, what is he in prison for? So that's when I learned about the Matthew Shepard case. And yeah, he's my dad's cousin. They grew up together, went to the same school. I think they were in the same grade. They were really, really close. They were in, I think it was junior high, like 6th or 7th grade. And yeah, they had a class together and they had a substitute for a few days. And they looked so much alike that they swapped seats and were just like, oh, my dad was like, oh, I'm Aaron. And Aaron was like, oh, I'm Tim, my dad, just for fun. Yeah, they were really close. They were friends. So I think that's also just might be why my dad is kind of so defensive about it. My dad is really adamant, like, oh, it was not because Matthew was gay. It was because he owed Aaron drug money. To me, it just seems like maybe that had something to do with it, but I definitely don't think that that was the whole story at all. I think that had Matthew been a straight man and owed Aaron drug money, he would not have been so brutal.
And so at a certain point, you started to realize that you were bisexual. Can you tell the story of just your realization about that and how your family reacted to that?
My immediate family, like my parents and my siblings, were really supportive. I came out around that time that I had learned about Matthew, and I was scared of coming out to them because growing up, they had kind of made some jokes in passing, just like insensitive gay jokes. I kind of didn't realize, like, oh, those are jokes. They don't mean them. So I was scared of coming out, but right off the bat, they were really supportive. Yeah, my other relatives, like my aunts and uncles and stuff, not as much. I don't really talk to them for that reason. Being trans was a little bit different. Right away, they were kind of like, oh yeah, that's not a problem, which is, you know, definitely a reaction I was happy with. But it's been a little bit more difficult since then. I think it's only been recently my mom especially, I think, is kind of realizing, oh, this isn't an active choice that he's making. This isn't like who he wants to be. It's who he is. I think it's a little bit harder for my dad, especially when I first came out and before I got on hormones and stuff. After I got on hormones, it's been a little bit easier. But before that, it was like, oh, I'll always see you as my daughter. I'll be respectful of you, but I'm always going to see you as a girl, which really sucks. But yeah, since getting on testosterone, I think it's been a little bit easier for him. With my relatives, that's like the main reason I don't talk to them. They still call me my dead name. They still misgender me. So that's tough.
Yeah, yeah. And so, you know, when you talk to your friends about the fact that you're related to the murderer of Matthew Shepard, what is the reaction of your community? Or is it even something that you feel like you can talk about?
I normally don't really tell people unless I'm, like, pretty close with them or I know that it won't be, like, something that passes judgment, I guess. Like, yeah, my close friends know, and they're also gay. So, yeah, I think it was definitely initially a shock. I went to the Shepherd Symposium in 9th grade, I think, before I had even, like, I knew what had happened, but I guess I just didn't really think too much into it and the fact, like, oh, maybe this isn't something I should be going to. And yeah, definitely when it was like I announced myself as Tate McKinney, it was kind of like, what are you doing here? Which I can't really blame anyone for. I would be just as surprised.
Did you feel like you had to answer for that? That you had to defend yourself in some way?
Yeah, kind of. It was definitely like, well, I'm here as an LGBT person. I obviously don't want to like associate myself with Aaron in any way. Yeah, I guess sort of. It was something I felt like I had to defend myself over.
One of the things that I'm hearing from you is just the struggle of growing up in a small town like Laramie with that shadow of Matthew Shepard. You are really close to that. Do you have a message for other members of the LGBTQ community growing up in really small towns like this? Any advice you'd offer?
You just kind of have to trust that it'll get better. Definitely in junior high, I had a really hard time. I was picked on quite a bit, especially for being trans. I don't think most people didn't really care about the bi part. I think Laramie is pretty open, especially compared to other towns when it comes to sexuality, at least. I think it really is just kind of a matter of trusting that it'll get better and surrounding yourself with people that are supportive.
You know, in terms of reckoning with Matthew Shepard's murder and coming to terms with that as a community, as a town and as a state, what do you think might be the best way to move forward? Is it time to just, you know, move past it? Or is there still some things that need to be dealt with?
For me, I don't think it's something that, you know, you just want to forget by any means. Because if you forget it, then it's like, what's stopping it from happening again? It's just, it's been so long, and at this point, I think most people can agree it was because he was gay. In my opinion, I think all that there is really to be done at this point is just kind of recognizing it and not letting it happen again.
That was Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards speaking with Tate McKinney. Tate came forward to share his story after hearing the episode Small Town Drag Queen on the Modern West about the hardship of growing up LGBTQ in the rural West. You can find a link to that story under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Coming up, a logging plan in the Medicine Bow National Forest has generated some attention. It's all coming up on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News.
This time on the Modern West, it wasn't easy growing up queer in small town Wyoming. But now Taylor and Giselle are headed to the big city for a drag competition.
I'm still nervous, but a couple more sips of my tonic and we'll be just fine.
You're gonna break all the legs.
The Small Town Drag Queen. I'm Melody Edwards. Find the Modern West under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. The U.S. Forest Service is launching a plan for restoration in Medicine Bow National Forest. Although the Forest Service says the goal of the project is to create a healthier forest, environmental groups are critical of the plan. Wyoming Public Radio's Ashley Piccone reports.
Medicine Bow National Forest is a popular area for recreation in southeastern Wyoming, covering about 1 million acres of mountains, lakes, and more. The Landscape Vegetation Analysis, or LAVA project, gives the Forest Service the ability to treat over 200,000 acres of the forest with prescribed burns and logging. It also allows them to build up to 600 miles of temporary roads. Forest Supervisor Russ Bacon says the pine beetle infestation has killed a lot of trees in the forest.
The primary goal is really to address this sea of dead lodgepole, if you will, that is present on the landscape. Right now, we have a situation where we just don't have a very resilient forest.
But Connie Wilbert, the director of Sierra Club Wyoming chapter, says LAVA is a logging project.
It's deeply troubling that the Forest Service wants to accomplish this level of logging across the forest and build this many additional roads, which will just further fragment wildlife habitat and
make it almost impossible to find a place to go up there for people who like quiet recreation.
One question is where the forest treatment will specifically take place. Forest officials have not made that public, and Ted Zukoski at the Center for Biological Diversity says that's a problem.
What the Forest Service has done here is to say, we're not going to tell you where those roads are going to be built. We're not going to tell you when and how we're going to be implementing these clear cuts and other treatments. We'll figure that all out later. Trust us.
Zukoski says the lack of information is a violation of the National Environmental Policy Act.
NEPA performs two important jobs. First, it requires agencies to look before they leap, so to understand the environmental consequences of their actions before they act. And it requires the public to be informed and have an opportunity to be heard.
Zukoski says the Forest Service has designed such a large plan that it is impossible to study the results of lava. Forest Supervisor Bacon says the plan is broad because the problem is big.
We can't continue to meet this challenge, if you will, of large million-acre landscape with very small treatments. And lava really is designed to, over the course of this 15 years, to match the solution at scale with the challenge.
Bacon also says that the scope of lava will allow them to treat the forest in the best way possible.
All too often, when it comes to the National Environmental Policy Act, we as an agency have found ourselves in a situation where it takes us so long to plan a project that by the time we get through the planning, the conditions on the ground have changed.
Bacon says that one of the primary goals of lava is to prevent wildfires.
The fires that are burning in Colorado right now, I think they're really good reminders for us why lava is important.
Wilbert of the Sierra Club says that lava isn't the answer to the wildfire problem.
Drought and temperature are the two factors that are the most influential in forest fire frequency and intensity, not insect infestations.
The best way to prevent wildfire may be up for debate between the two sides, but the effects of the project on recreationalists are not. Wilbert and Bacon agree that the project will be noticeable.
If we're talking about commercial logging on as much as a quarter or a third of the forest over a relatively short period of time, 15 years, of course you're going to see it.
Bacon says the increased activity will come hand in hand with more access. Barring litigation, the lava project will move forward since it was approved by the Forest Service this month. Bacon says the Forest Service will request input from stakeholders and the public throughout the duration of the project. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Ashley Piccone.
One controversial issue that never seems to go away surrounds trapping. The Wyoming Game and Fish Department is considering changes to laws and regulations surrounding trapping. This is after some encounters members of the public and pets have had with traps near public areas. Some want trapping near trails banned. Others say pets should just be leashed. Well, a working group has looked into solutions. Lander Region Wildlife Supervisor Jason Hunter joins me to discuss what they're proposing.
Yeah, so I think, you know, just like you said, you know, there's two extremes, but I think there's a lot of room in the middle, as with most things. And so I hope, you know, again, if we have good attendance, whether it's in person or as part of the virtual meetings, and good conversation, and be able to come up with, like I said, some of the things everyone can somewhat agree on or generally support or see the benefit in. And some of those things, you know, are as simple as education. You know, we're looking at potentially mandatory trapper education. That's going to come up as a discussion topic. We're also looking at education for public land users in general. So they know trapping does occur on the landscape, and you know maybe these are some things you need to look for, or these times of year, you know, trapping may be more prevalent. How to release pets from a trap if it does happen. Those are some of the things we're looking at, as well as you know signage has come up a lot lately, and looking at potentially some signage on you know some of our commission-owned lands that. Again, just make sure it's known that that trapping is an accepted use on these properties, and you know, some kind of a link on a sign that'll allow people to go to our website and get more information. We also want to look at, you know, maybe there's some of our properties that some commission-owned properties that we release pheasants on, for example, that maybe it's appropriate to have trapping closures during certain times of the year. Maybe not all types of traps, because we do know that I'll take Ocean Lake, for example. There are a number of people that if they're after raccoons, they use a trap that you know, pretty much only raccoons are going to put their hand into. So they're going to, you know, it's not going to affect those pheasant hunters using dogs out there. So those are things that I hope come up in the conversation and things we can look at. Some other things that we're going to talk about are setbacks on trails and trailheads and camping areas. So basically that's a distance away from a trail that an individual could place a trap. We've heard a lot of reports that there are a number of trappers that trap right on public trails. I haven't experienced that much, but again, it's something that we'll talk about. And so what we're throwing out as a starting point is, you know, from public trails that are, we'll have to come up with a definition there, but 30 feet from public trails and I think 300 feet from campgrounds, trailheads, busy places like that.
Jason, can you enforce these as a game and fish, or are these just recommendations? I'm curious, when you get into federal lands and that kind of thing, what actually can you do?
Right. And so right now we have in place, there are laws and regulations in place about checking traps. There are laws and regulations about trap types and specifications for snares specifically, for loop size. Every trap has to have a trapper ID on it. All of those things we can enforce, whether it's fur bearer or predatory, whether it's private land or public land. So these recommendations we're talking about, a lot of them, they would require a statutory change. So we would have to work with the legislature on that before we could implement those into commission regulation.
Has the commission come around on this? Because I know there's been a ton. I mean, this issue has come up before them, and they've just flat out rejected some of these things. Are they starting? What's maybe changed their mind? And
yeah, and I don't know that it's changing their mind. I think it's more that they didn't have a lot of information on what was going on with trapping, and so rather than jumping to conclusions one way or the other, they asked us to put this committee together, look at, you know, the history of the statutes and regulations, contact a broad group of stakeholders, and move forward this way so they could be better informed.
So, Jason, tell me about these public hearings. Where are they going to be, and you know, how can people access them?
On September 1st, we'll be in Rock Springs at the White Mountain Library, and then the next day, next evening, we'll travel to Jackson at the Ward Hotel. And then on the 3rd, the following day, we'll head up to Sheridan at the Best Western Sheridan Center. And those will all be in-person meetings. All the meetings will start at 6 p.m. The following week, we will head over to Laramie, and we'll have a meeting on the 9th, September 9th, at our Game and Fish Regional Office. It'll be an in-person meeting, and we'll have a virtual option available as well that we'll ask folks to pre-register for. On the 10th, we'll finish up in Lander at the Inn at Lander in the Wind River Room. And again, that'll be an in-person meeting as well as a virtual option. So we're offering two virtual options to hopefully capture as many people in the state being able to participate as who want to.
Jason Hunter, again, is with the Wyoming Game and Fish Department. And Jason, if you can resolve this, we might give you guys some tougher issues. So good luck with all of this, because this has been a hot-button one for a long time.
Absolutely. And I'm really looking forward to these meetings and these conversations. I think there'll be a lot of positive that comes out in the end.
Thank you. Let's step away from controversy. Cody is the first community in Wyoming to have a local chapter of the national mountain bike program called Little Bellas. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska explains how the program hopes to teach girls not only mountain bike skills, but also friendship and self-growth.
A group of girls are going in circles playing musical chairs, except there are no chairs, just orange cones. And they are all on mountain bikes. Eight-year-old Everly Jean Henry is one of the last to finish, but misses the cone.
I like bike riding, and I decided I should also learn about how to mountain bike.
Everly is one out of 17 girls in the Cody chapter of Little Bellas. The National Mountain Biking Mentor Program is a summer program for girls between the ages of 7 and 12. It's geared towards kids like Everly who want to learn how to mountain bike. They do it through unique games like musical chairs and obstacle courses.
We had an obstacle right here where we are right now, and we had logs and trees, and it went down over there and came back. It was really fun.
9-year-old Charlotte Quick chimes in.
There's like a rubber chicken, and you have to ride over it. And then you have to limbo under a noodle.
And on your bike?
Yeah, on your bike. And then you have to go in like kind of a maze of cones, and then you have to go over some boards.
Little Bella makes a point that the adults are mentors, not coaches. And Cody mentor Nyla Hurley says the reason is so the kids can have fun, make friends, and grow while not focusing entirely on mountain bike skills. Hurley says Cody is lucky to have a great bike trail system, which has created communities already.
And we have a very strong female mountain bike community. That's where we kind of were pulling our mentors in from. And a lot of those mentors have kids in the program.
Back when Hurley grew up in Cody, the trail system didn't exist.
I wish I had something like this when I was growing up here. And I think, you know, female friendship and finding a love for a sport that you can continue on your entire life is really important.
And that's actually a goal of the National Little Bellas platform.
It was really born out of a nature or a, you know, an effort to build community on bikes with women.
That's Sabra Davidson. She's the executive director and co-founder of Little Bellas.
We just noticed that there weren't women riding together. And you know, in turn, there weren't girls and kids riding together. There was this drop-off of kids going out on bikes.
Davidson says the idea is for the girls to explore their own backyards.
We wanted to bring the fun of exploring the outdoors and being with a pack of kids and having that as part of their day and teach them something that was inherently hard and challenging.
Davidson says the organization is there to support the local chapters. They provide snacks, jerseys, and all the equipment needed for training. In addition, if a girl doesn't have a bike or any type of equipment, Little Bellas provides scholarships and financial support. Back at practice, mentors check whether all the girls have their gear on correctly.
Okay, so how do we check our helmets? What do we do first? That looks a little loosey-goosey there, Libby.
Your piece fingers, and then I want to make sure it stays on the noggin.
Once all the girls have their helmets on tight, they decide what they want to do for the afternoon.
Or do you want to just hit the trail and see how far we can go today?
Do
you want to
do jump lines?
Let's go see if it's open.
And off they go. Everly bikes quickly up the hill and squeals each time she rides down the hill.
Yeehaw!
Something she couldn't do just a couple of weeks earlier. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Camila Kudelska at the Center of the West in Cody.
Stay with us. In a moment, we will shift our attention to the arts. This is Open Spaces.
Sometimes at the end of a long day,
The best thing I know to do is totally escape into a really good story.
North Park has always been my healing place. Is this now a dangerous place?
He's really open, so I need to be open.
And that was when Oliver really started to show us what a talent he had.
I'm Erin Jones. Find Human Nature under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. The Jackson Hole Center for the Arts has announced a new executive director. It's Marty Camino, who joined the center in 2018 as Events Services Director and served as Chief Operations Officer over the last year. He spoke with Wyoming Public Radio's Micah Schweitzer about stepping into the executive director role when much of the organization's programming has been rearranged by the pandemic.
You know, it is a challenging time to step into this role, and a challenging time for arts organizations across our state and across the country. Right now, it is a question of how can we continue to connect our community to serve that very important need for the arts, for culture, for a creative outlet, even if that means accomplishing it through virtual means. In the last 4 months, we have presented 30 live stream events from our theater. We've reached over 30,000 audience members through that virtual platform.
I assume that you're now reaching people beyond the typical confines of Jackson and the, you know, the Teton area.
And that is one of the advantages of this virtual programming. It's interesting because it launched as a necessity during this time. But as we get back to quote-unquote normal, whatever that looks like, we will have to take a hard look at what this continues to offer us, whether part of the new normal is events in our theater that we can simultaneously offer through a virtual platform, whether that's free or a ticketed version of that. That's certainly one thing that I anticipate will continue developing. One advantage that we have is a beautiful theater, and we have a technical production crew. Thanks as well to PPP funding, we've been able to keep those people employed to produce these live streams from our stage with full lights and sound production and multiple camera shots. A very high production quality.
We're talking with Marty Camino. He's the new executive director of the Jackson Hole Center for the Arts. How does this change or enhance the role of the Center for the Arts statewide, in your perspective?
One conversation that we have had is in this virtual realm, you know, how does shifting programs, whether it's performances from the theater, whether it's classes and other offerings, how does the virtual platform allow us to reach a wider audience across the state to communities that may not have such an incredible community resource? How can we serve a bigger role in arts and culture?
From a financial perspective, I can't imagine virtual events have quite the same effect as packing a theater with actual people.
And that is one of the big challenges that we face moving forward. We are a nonprofit organization, so we are able to solicit and secure donations and philanthropic support. We don't receive any government funding or financial support from the town or the county or the state. We have to really explore new opportunities to generate revenue as we realize really how long the ripple effect of this pandemic is likely to be for arts organizations like ours.
You know, I don't know if you have a crystal ball on hand, Marty, but
I wish.
Yeah, exactly. What do you think the new normal might start to look like for an arts organization such as yours?
In the short term, at least thinking over the next year or so, my crystal ball says that national touring acts will not be able to make the numbers work again until they are able to pack a theater. So what that makes me think is that we have to look at what our regional artists are doing. What is some local programming that we can do, but maybe at a lower production cost, and therefore we can offer a lower ticket cost or make the numbers work with not a complete packed theater, but still a strong attendance of people spaced out appropriately.
Yeah, I mean, there's going to be a whole new meaning to sold out, I suppose.
I think so, absolutely. And even the financial models of what makes a production successful and how you cover those costs, we are having to rethink all of those budgeting processes.
Do you see any silver linings? And this is a hard time for the arts in general, but do you see silver linings?
I do. I think, as I said, as a nonprofit, we've seen a lot of people really step up and show their support of the arts. The other thing I would say is we have an interesting model at the Center for the Arts in that there are 20 independent nonprofit organizations who occupy that campus. And this time has presented an opportunity for us to work much more collaboratively and cooperatively than we ever have before. And I think a lot of arts organizations are coming together to support one another to make sure that they can all come through this time and continue to deliver on their missions and serve that need in our communities.
Marty Camino is the new executive director of the Jackson Hole Center for the Arts. Marty, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Micah. My pleasure.
Thanks for listening to Open Spaces. If you missed part of the program or want to find an individual segment, it's all available at our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Our stories are also on social media, including Facebook. And you'll never miss an episode if you sign up for our podcast on our website or wherever you get your podcasts. Anna Rader is our web editor. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.